I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There's no doubt that Missouri is an agriculture state, but what happens when nearly 7,000 head of cattle move in next door? Some folks in Johnson County, Missouri, don't want to find out. That's why they're fighting to keep a local meat producer just down the way from Powell Gardens from expanding. Today we'll find out how these confined animal feeding operations are coming under attack, and we'll ask, if a farm isn't breaking any laws, why shouldn't they be allowed to expand? Then we recall the social justice pioneer Lucille Bluford and how she gave a voice to black residents of Kansas City through her newspaper, The Call. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Powell Gardens appears to be fighting for its life. The Botanical Gardens on Highway 50 east of Kansas City is seeking an administrative appeal of a June decision by the Missouri DNR to grant a permit for up to 7,000 beef cattle for Valley Oaks Steaks. Established just east of Lone Jack in 2016, the feedlot and slaughtering plant currently maintains fewer than 950 head. But the concentrated animal feeding operation, as it's called, is seeking to change that, located as it is just 3 miles from the gardens. That means the potential for a stench that might keep visitors to Powell Gardens far, far away. Now a conversation about where all this is headed. With us, Madeline Beck is a reporter with Harvest Public Media based in Galesburg, Illinois. She joins us now via Skype. Madeline, good morning.
Good morning.
Tabitha Schmidt is the CEO of Powell Gardens. And Tabitha, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Leslie Holloway is the Senior Director of Regulatory Affairs for the Missouri Farm Bureau. Leslie, nice to have you too.
Thank you.
Tabitha, let's start with the latest news, and maybe you can bring us up to speed here. Powell Gardens is seeking this administrative appeal to stave off this expansion by Valley Oaks Steaks, and it also seeks a permanent injunction in Jackson County, Missouri. Do we have answers to either of these requests at this point?
We don't. Monday, we had the first appeal hearing for the stay to temporarily halt the permit. We're waiting on the decision. We hope to know something in a couple of weeks on that. And then the injunction component is the status hearing is scheduled for October, but we're trying to move that date up.
Okay, so these things are still very much in flux.
There's quite a bit in flux.
Leslie, is there an expected outcome here? I mean, do those close to this situation think they know what the result's going to be?
Well, Steve, I really couldn't speak to that. As an organization, Farm Bureau has not taken a position one way or the other on this permit as we would approach any specific permit. So I really can't speak to that.
Tabitha Schmidt again with Powell Gardens. If you don't come out on the winning side of either of these, then what happens?
Powell Gardens isn't going anywhere. We're planning for our future. We're forging ahead. We are worried about this particular CAFO. We've always been worried about this one.
CAFO, again, concentrated animal feeding
yes.
operation.
Correct.
Right?
We're not anti-CAFO. We've been painted that way by the Cattlemen's Association. That is not true. We are pro-farm, pro-farmer. We have a 12-acre edible landscape all about seed to plate. We preach this. We teach this. The issue with this particular facility is it's 3 miles from the garden. It is in a very dense population area. It's close to a botanical garden, and our mission is antithetical to what this operation is. It's also the size, over almost 7,000 head of cattle under roofs, so you're talking manure, urine. It's also a slaughtering operation and a retail operation. This is right now, because the permit has been approved, it is the largest beef CAFO in the entire state of Missouri.
Wow.
And it is the densest population. It makes no sense why they picked this location.
So there are 7,000 head of cattle on this operation right now?
Not yet. They have, we found out Monday, they are at 1,900. They should be at 4,600 by the end of the year, going into 6,500 in next year. I'm not sure exactly when that would be, but it will be a fully operational if they continued with the permit.
Well, let's be clear here, though, Tabitha. If this operation does ratchet up to 7,000 head of cattle, the concern here is that the stench from that manure and all those animals might discourage people from coming out to Powell Gardens.
It is a big concern. That is one of many of our concerns. The odor is obviously a major issue. I mean, even if you're just driving to Powell Gardens and you pass that operation, you know, you will remember that smell. I mean, I've had more people tell me, oh, you've been out to Kansas. You know what that smells like, right? That's what they remember. We are also worried about the pests that could come. We're a living collection, a botanical garden, a museum. And if there's an increase in insects that could eat our collection, we have some rare and endangered species out there. It's just two different worlds in what we're trying to do and what they're doing. They're not compatible.
So the concerns that are being expressed here aren't coming only from Powell Gardens.
Oh, no. The neighbors, the Lone Jack neighbor area, my understanding is there's about 800 residences within 3 miles of the operation. Families, centennial farms, which means they've been in a family for at least 100 years or more. And these are farmers. These are cattle farmers. They farm their fields. And so it's very sad, to be frank, the division that it's caused in that community, because really everyone is pro-farm and pro-farming, but this is factory farming, and that is the difference.
Leslie Holloway, again with the Missouri Farm Bureau. It's your view, if I understand correctly, that if Valley Oaks is meeting the requirements for an operation like this, what, they should be allowed to expand?
Yes, exactly. We have state laws, state regulations, federal laws, federal regulations in place that are effective. They have been effective. These types of confined livestock operations have been operating in Missouri and throughout the nation for many, many years. Missouri actually was in the forefront in putting laws and regulations into place to make sure that there are adequate permitting of these types of livestock facilities. And I have to, with all due respect, question some of the allegations that have been raised with regard to the Valley Oaks operation. I won't speak to it specifically. I'm not familiar enough to be able to speak to it specifically. But I do know from various conversations, news reports, some of the information that Powell Gardens has put out in an effort to rally the opposition, that there are fears being ginned up that simply are not supported.
But Leslie, this isn't complicated. At the end of the day, this operation is going to stink to high heaven. You got residents nearby. You got Powell Gardens within 3 miles. What do you say to those people?
Why do you think this operation will stink to high heaven? That's one of the allegations.
Because there's 7,000 cattle.
Well, are you familiar with the way cattle are raised in a confined operation?
No, I mean, I've lived in the Midwest for a long time. I know what this stuff smells like.
I don't think you've been around a confined cattle operation, at least not in Missouri, because it's a very unique operation, as Tabitha has pointed out, coming into Missouri now. And so, yes, they have had to meet some very stringent requirements in Missouri in particular.
So you're saying it won't smell?
I am not saying that because, again, I am not familiar enough with the operation, but I don't know where you come up with the allegation that it's going to stink to high heaven. That is just one of the many allegations that really, I think, comes back down to the question of the term factory farm. That is a term that is used by people who are opposed to a certain size of farm. And unfortunately, farming, like many other types of businesses, has become bigger over the years. And there are many people who simply are opposed to what they consider to be a large farm operation. And that's really the basis of the opposition.
But what I'm hearing here is that folks don't oppose large farm operations. What they oppose are large farm operations located near homes and located near places like Powell Gardens that brings in thousands of visitors every year to visit the gardens.
There are some folks who are motivated by that particular concern. Powell Gardens has expressed that concern. There are a number of others who may or may not be in the area who are involved in the opposition whose main purpose is to try to stop the advancement of what they consider to be large farm operations. And I would like to point out that countering some of the misinformation, approximately 97% of the farms in the United States are family farms. Approximately 88% of those, according to USDA, they would categorize as small farms.
Right.
So there is a real misunderstanding, which is really unfortunate. And one of the things that our organization tries to do is to bring more of the facts out so that people have a better understanding. As people become further and further removed from farming, they don't understand modern farming.
Tabitha Schmidt, again, the CEO of Powell Gardens. I'll let you have a chance to respond here. Yeah.
Sure. I think one thing that's really important to note about Valley Oaks is that they applied for a Class 1B permit, which is one head of cattle under 7,000. And by doing that particular permit, they do not have as many regulations and rules that they have to follow. So I think there's been a lot that we have been very concerned about how this has happened. The other thing I think that is very telling, and I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but I would encourage the listeners to look this up, is that the mission statement of the DNR was rewritten under the Greitens administration about a year ago without public input, is my understanding. And if you read what it was a year ago and what it is now, it's definitely the emphasis now is more about business connected to the natural environment. And what's interesting about DNR is this permit, the only thing that the DNR permit is concerned about is water. They're not concerned about any
the potential contamination.
Yeah, surface water and groundwater contamination. Rightly so, that's very important. You know, watersheds and different tributaries and everything. But our natural resources are more than water. And so this has been one of the very frustrating components for Powell Gardens because, you know, we are a botanical garden. We are about nature. We're about preserving, protecting, conserving, and educating and sharing with the public. And so just learning and how all this has changed just in the last year with the DNR has been very disheartening, to be honest. You know, we only have so much to take care that we can take care of, and we're worried that this is the focus has not been accurate, that has not been thoroughly thought out.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about Powell Gardens and a large cattle operation now underway just a few miles away from Powell Gardens and how this is affecting life out east of Kansas City here. I want to bring in Madeline Beck to our conversation. Again, she's with Harvest Public Media based here at KCUR. You know, Johnson County, Missouri is not the only place, Madeline, where these legal battles are playing out across the country. You've been monitoring things in Iowa and North Carolina where dozens of lawsuits have been filed. Tell us what you're seeing in places like that.
Well, yeah, it's those places and around the nation generally that there is an increase in tensions around CAFOs, or what some people call them, factory farms, because those are becoming more common. There are more of them, specifically in North Carolina. It's been against hog farms, just specifically because they have large pits of liquid waste out, and it's sprayed directly over fields. That smell, even if it is legally permitted, these spaces, like if they do get permits from the state, these neighbors have filed nuisance lawsuits saying it is infringed on their ability to enjoy or use their property. And recently, many in North Carolina have won those lawsuits, not against the farmer itself, but oftentimes farmers work for large companies and raise their animals. And so that's what's happening there. But I think what's really important to talk about here in Missouri and the rest of the nation is something called a right to farm law. And those are kind of at the heart of all of these. All states have this right to farm law that was generally created that if you have farms out in the country and people move out to the country, don't like the smell, they're meant to protect the farms from those people suing because they don't like the smell now that they've moved out to the country. And that's a lot of the time the basis of these lawsuits and a lot of these arguments is the smell and pollution. Missouri's own right to farm law is pretty strict. Once a factory farm or a large farm, that is a farm when it comes to cattle, that's about 1,000 beef cattle. Once that is been established for a year and there hasn't been a nuisance, then people can't file a nuisance lawsuit against it unless there is a substantial change that would affect pollution or groundwater. Or if, yeah, that's pretty much one of the only ways you can file at that point.
And this right to farm law, Madeline, just passed a couple of years ago, intensely controversial in Missouri when it is up for a vote.
Yeah, I mean, and it's controversial all over the place because the question really is, what is a person's private property right? Mm-hmm. What if this farm is infringing on my private property right by making it so I can't enjoy or use my property?
Right.
Actually, there is a little bit of a clarification.
Yeah.
The right to farm laws, I think, that you referred to earlier that were passed throughout the nation, those were actually in the 70s and 80s. That's when the original right to farm laws. There was an amendment that was passed that we supported recently here in Missouri to strengthen that right to farm law. But that there is a separation in what the purposes of those laws are.
Madeline, do you have any sense? We were talking earlier about the potential for odor coming from a cattle operation of up to nearly 7,000 head of cattle that we're talking about here just east of Lone Jack here. Even though Leslie was saying these things are in confined structures, what's your sense based on your own experience? Do these things, an operation of that size, would that smell or would it not?
Well, I mean, it would smell, but the amount of smell is what everyone's going to be arguing about here.
All right.
It's a relative, right? Yeah. If you're a farmer, right, you can handle more than if maybe you're an urbanite.
Okay.
And at the same time, there are new technologies that oftentimes newer farms and newer expansions have to abide by stricter regulations when it comes to, you have to use these newer technologies to make sure the smell is abated. But of course, the question is, what's the line between is it abated enough? Mm-hmm. And that's a question that every community and neighbor and farmer is going to have to ask themselves.
Steve, could I talk about the economic impact is something I think that is very interesting here. You know, the Valley Oaks side talks a lot about bringing jobs to that area, but what they need to understand is we can have up to 90 people working at the height of the season at the gardens. So it's a trade-off depending on how this goes forward, right? The other thing that's happening out there already is home prices are falling. There have been contracts that have been pulled out because once they heard about the operation, people were pulling out. We know this firsthand from some realtors that we've been talking to. And I think what's interesting, especially to the Lee Summit community, and I have visited with the mayor a bit about this, is that that whole east side of the city has been a high growth area. And Lone Jack is basically a suburb of Lee Summit, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is going to halt that growth. It's going to halt the growth. People will not move that way. It will hurt the economic impact, the development of that side of the city.
You know, Madeline, you wrote a story for Harvest Public Media that suggests a different tactic that neighbors of these feed operations are using. They have started suing the meat companies instead of the farmers. How does that work?
Well, basically, what's been happening, this has just been practiced in North Carolina for the most part at this point, but oftentimes, farmers, whether they're facing a lot of debt, they're facing a lot of challenges farming for themselves, will start growing animals for a big company. So in this case, it was they started growing for a subsidiary of Smithfield Foods, which is the largest pork producer in the United States. And so what people have done is instead of suing their neighbor, who is the farmer who is growing these animals, they've gone after the company. And that's for a few reasons. One being that's where the money's at, right? Your neighbor farmer probably isn't making that much, even though they're working for a big company. But at the second point in that is they're going to do that because a lot of the time these contracts are confidential, and there has been a lot of controversy over whether sometimes these companies' contracts don't pay the farmers much at all. They basically exploit farmers who are in a very difficult situation, saying, we'll pay you, and we'll pay you regularly. And by doing so, they've underpaid these farmers. And so the farmers themselves can't pay for remediations or updates to their facilities that might make it smell less, that might make there be less fecal pollution in the air. Right. And so that's hopefully that answers your question
right.
about what's going on there.
You know, one more thing, Madeline. You've watched a few of these legal efforts progress, like the ones up here now involving Powell Gardens. Could court rulings, you know, and could the courts keep this expansion from happening indefinitely? Is that a possibility here?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to say indefinitely whenever you talk about legal challenges, because the legislature plays a big role, and the legislature might change, right? And the federal laws may change. Right now, a lot of these laws are strictly up to states, and those oftentimes are changed or amended, like what was just mentioned. You guys voted on an amendment to either strengthen those laws or take them back a little bit. So, I mean, I think that there could be some state protections that mitigate how much things can be expanded, but I think indefinitely is a very strong word.
Tabitha Schmidt, again, the CEO of Powell Gardens. You know, what kind of reaction from your patrons are you getting about all this?
Thank you. That's a great question. Overwhelming support. We have lost a few members, but not very many.
You've lost them because?
Because they disagree with our opposition to Valley Oaks. But for the most part, the majority, huge percentage, we've got new members. We've got more support. We've got a lot of people asking what can they do to help. And so there is our website with all this information and how you can help. And, you know, we want to be here for ever. You know, that's the plan. We're a cultural treasure, and we want to be here for the public and the community and continue to do what we do and grow and be better at what we do.
Leslie Holloway, again, with Missouri Farm Bureau. How tough is the Farm Bureau prepared to fight and wage this battle going forward?
We have been supporting agriculture of all sizes. That's what we're all about. And so as long as they're meeting the statutory and the regulatory requirements, we think that they have every right, just like any other business would, to operate. And if it's a family farm especially, we want to see that family farm continue. We want to strengthen agriculture in Missouri. And I'll just add, as one last point, the environmental record here in Missouri is very good. And so that should be evidence that the laws and the regulations in place are effective.
Is there a compromise here? Can something be worked out that might be, you know, amenable to both parties as you look at this?
Well, I certainly hope so. We have worked in the past trying to work with county officials as well as others who are generally opposed to CAFOs to try to come up with some accommodation that meets all sides, because this is no fun for a family farm, and Valley Oaks is a family farm. This is no fun for them to have to go through all this, especially when they feel like they're doing everything they can to demonstrate that they're going to do things the right way, not being given a chance potentially.
Are they open to shrinking the size of the herd?
I don't have any idea.
Yeah. Any insights here, Tabitha?
We are open to remedies, ideas. You know, we're working on trying to figure out what this looks like.
Are there talks going on with Valley Oaks?
Not yet. We have attempted a tour, but they started putting conditions on the tour at who could come. And so we decided not to do it because they wouldn't allow our experts, our legal counsel, or myself to be present.
You know, as the CEO of Powell Gardens, when was the first time you heard about this operation? And I'm wondering what your first reactions to it were.
Actually, I found out about it from a woman in Lone Jack who owns one of the Centennial Farms that abuts the property. And she sent me through email the letter that they were required to send. It's a 3,000-foot buffer that they were required to send. We got the letter, or I got the letter, I believe it was in February, but don't quote me. It's been quite a thing.
Right.
And I alerted my board, and the more we just started understanding what was happening, the more concerned we became. There was no hearing at the time. It was coming within 2 weeks, really hard and fast. So we started working hard to get the public hearing. Huge attendance in Warrensburg, probably, we're guessing, maybe 800 people, standing room only. To try to push and make the case to not grant the permit, but DNR did grant the permit.
I was going to say, is DNR, the new governor, Mike Parson, state lawmakers, or is there any hope they're working with those folks going forward?
We don't know yet. Mm-hmm. We've been wondering if there is, but we haven't got any indication that things might change yet. But we're looking at it.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. What an interesting dilemma all this is. That was just the voice of Tabitha Schmidt, the CEO of Powell Gardens. Leslie Holloway is also here, the Senior Director of Regulatory Affairs for the Missouri Farm Bureau. And Madeline Beck joined us as well, a reporter with Harvest Public Media. Thank you all for a good conversation. We'll stay in touch on this thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics. We're going to turn to Lucille Bluefer, the longtime editor and publisher of the Kansas City Call, and what her legacy remains today. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we found out what books you should pack for the beach, the pool, or just about anywhere. Find our book critics' recommendations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history is more than just the tragic tale of a sinking ship. It's a true story involving nuclear weapon transport, shark attacks, and a wrongful conviction that lingered for decades. We'll have that conversation tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, look how far Lucille Bluefer has come. The one-time editor and publisher of the Kansas City Call, a newspaper that caters to African Americans, was denied admission to the University of Missouri in Columbia a whopping 11 times. This year, a residence hall there was named in her memory. Also this year, a new book is out recalling her life and times. That book, Lucille H. Bluefer and the Kansas City Call, Activist Voice for Social Justice. One of the book's co-authors joins me now as we continue our ongoing coverage of race and the plight of the poor in Kansas City. That's Sheila Brooks. She's a Kansas City native who grew up across the street from the Call. Sheila Brooks is a former television reporter, anchor, news director, and documentary producer who founded and heads the Washington, D.C.-based SRB Communications. Sheila, so nice to have you here. Welcome back to Kansas City.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
Now, you can't help but wonder what Lucille Bluefer would think about the University of Missouri this year, naming a residence hall after her when that same university once denied her admission, not once, but 11 times.
Absolutely. I know she would be astonished.
Yes, I'm sure.
As a young reporter, that's how she began her activism career here in Kansas City at the Call, and went on to spur that career over 70 years at the Kansas City Call. And then when she, of course, was denied admission to the University of Missouri's graduate school, not once, not twice, 11 times, as you said, it was success when the Missouri State Supreme Court said, you must admit this woman. And then the graduate school shut its doors. So she had to go to Lincoln University, about 30 miles away. There was no journalism school there in 1941.
Right.
But for those historians that know and those who don't, that set the stage for the first journalism school to be created at a historically black college and university in this country.
You know, I just like to would love a chance to walk Lucille Bluefer around that residence hall and to see how she would react to seeing that name to her. When did she first apply for admission to the University of Missouri?
She applied for admission to the University of Missouri in 1939, and she was admitted. But when she showed up to register for her first day of classes, that's when the registrar saw that she was an African-American woman and was asked to leave.
And that was the reason she was denied, the color of her skin.
She was denied because of the color of her skin. And that legal battle that she had over those next 3 years, from 1939 to 1941, it became the catalyst of her 70-year career of activism for the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement.
How did she react, you know, Sheila, to being turned down to the main central school in her home state of Missouri?
She was not a happy woman. She sent a telegram, and we have a copy of that telegram in the book on her. She sent the telegram back to the registrar and said, you denied me, and when you had already admitted me, and I want to come to school there. And he returned the telegram and said, no, ma'am, you cannot come to school here.
Why did you want to write a book about her?
I was looking for a topic for my dissertation research. I decided to do a PhD in my later years in life, and I wanted to showcase an African-American woman who used the power of the press. And I looked at the mainstream media because that's where we come from.
Yes.
But I couldn't find that type of woman who used that, the structure that she owned, the press, to actually talk about her standpoint on those issues of unrest that were going on in the 1960s, 1970s civil rights movement. So I had to look to community newspapers. I had to look to the black press, which has always been a slant of advocacy for us in the African-American community.
I was going to say, these newspapers are a little different because they do take on an advocacy tint that is different than what you would find in mainstream newspapers like the Kansas City Star.
Yes, and like the Kansas City Call. And she, Lucille Bluford, showed this unique angle of her vision, her writing about the unrest within education, integration, politics. And she became a formidable voice during those times that she had to even use a pseudonym, not just a pseudonym name, not just Lucille Bluford, but Louis Blue. She wrote under the name Louis Blue, a male pseudonym, for many years because for some time she was afraid of saying the kinds of things in those stories and commentaries in the Kansas City Call.
I was going to say she tended to use that pseudonym when she was sort of letting it loose a little bit and going after somebody with some pretty harsh commentary, right?
Absolutely she was. And she really got involved in the community. She was a member of the NAACP. She actually sat in on sit-ins and demonstrations. She attended those. She not only attended those protests and marches, she was a part of the civil rights movement protests and marches. And as a journalist in the mainstream media, that's not something that we can do. But for a weekly black-owned newspaper, she used her storytelling, her personal experiences that were happening to her as a black feminist during those times to talk about the unrest that was going on.
You know, you don't hear journalists with 70-year careers at one outlet like the Kansas City Call, and we're talking about Lucille Bluford here. Why did she stick around so long? Do you have any feel for that?
I think she wanted to make a difference. She wanted to share her experiences of the struggle of oppressions so she could inform the public and the larger society of gender and racial consciousness. In order to do that, you have to stick around for a while. You have to share that gender and racial view from so that society, women, and African Americans in the community can learn and grow and be a part of your experience.
We're talking about the legacy of Lucille Bluford, the editor and publisher of the Kansas City Call. My guest, Sheila Brooks, will speak about the life of Lucille Bluford and her new book at 6:30 this evening at the Central Branch Public Library, 14 West 10th Street downtown, 6:30 this evening to see and hear Sheila Brooks. I want to talk specifically about some of her stories, Sheila, because there's a fearless aspect to what she did. Let's go to 1968 in the aftermath of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, because Miss Bluford focused on riots in this town. At one point, she blamed the police for throwing tear gas on nonviolent student protesters. We've talked about that incident here on this program. She accused police of inciting riots and arson that led to 4 days of civil unrest and left 7 dead. You can't help but wonder how the police reacted to that and to what extent she was in danger for saying what she was saying.
And her account of what was going on, I lived those experiences. I was in fifth grade here at Holy Name Catholic Church and school right here on 23rd and Benton.
Right.
And we experienced all of what she wrote about then. But as a young person then, it took me until my adult life to conduct this research to really realize the impact of what was occurring in our town during the Kansas City riots. And she told the real stories. And of course, police and others disliked that, but this was her account of the lives and the conditions of what was happening in Kansas City during that time.
You know, as she looked back on her life, you almost can't help but wonder how she reflected on it. Do we know?
I think that she always wanted to be remembered as a good reporter. I think she said that many times to a couple of African-American reporters at the Kansas City Star that mm-hmm. I know. Mm-hmm. She wanted to tell the true stories of what was really going on in the community. It was a time, an era for all of us of oppressions and struggles, whether they were racial or gender related.
Right.
And she really wanted people to know in this city that we could, as a people, do something about it.
You know, in 1976, she took dead aim at the public schools in Kansas City, Missouri. What was her objection to what those schools were?
She really wanted to break down the barriers of inequalities and injustices against women and blacks. She wanted to ensure that we had integrated those schools, that we were being educated properly. I remember being bused across town from the east side. It's from 16th and Myrtle all the way over to St. Joseph Catholic School. On 18th Street.
Right.
And it was because of her voice, her stature, her leadership in the community that made so much of that education possible for us growing up.
You know, Leslie, Sheila, I'm sorry. Was The Call a newspaper that virtually every African-American family subscribed to back in those days?
I think it's a newspaper that not only every African-American family subscribed to back in those days, but in these days,
these
too.
Days
but
too.
Certainly then. I grew up reading the Kansas City Call. I grew up watching the news here in Kansas City, and that's what was an inspiration for me to get into the journalism business. My mother would read the Call to us before we could read ourselves. So when we sat there as a family.
You remember that as a kid?
I remember all of that as a kid growing up. Yes, sir.
Yeah, let's pause here. I want to listen to a recording we made this week of Mamie Hughes talking about Lucille Bluford. Mamie is close to a contemporary of Miss Bluford's and a former Jackson County legislator, one of the first women to serve there. She's also a founding member of the Central Exchange and a past chairwoman of the Mid-America Regional Council. Here's Mamie Hughes talking about Lucille Bluford.
I first met Miss Bluford in 1949 when I came to Kansas City. I knew her as a friend and someone very involved in the community. Lucille was interested and was very inspirational in the things I was doing. One of the things she shared was her love for words, the power of words. And when she learned that my mother had taught English, she said, "Well, we both will appreciate not only words and the power thereof, but the proper usage of words." So we just talked about how the issues involving women, but just people in general, and how a better world could be when we all could learn to appreciate the things each of us was involved and how we that could make us enjoy a better community. Within the black community, there were a number of good and wonderful things that were not reported in the Kansas City Star, but she would know about those things, and she would write about things that people liked or sometimes didn't like, but they were things that the entire community need to know about. And she was well respected as an expert journalism, and that she not only loved her work, which spilled over into the good things about Kansas City, but she dealt with the fact that people saw the kindness which her words show as a weakness, but she said, "Oh no," and her progress, her prowess was really a gift to Kansas City.
That's Mamie Hughes recalling the life and times of Lucille Bluford. Again, we're talking with Sheila Brooks, co-author of a new book on Lucille Bluford titled Lucille Bluford and the Kansas City Call, Activist Voice for Social Justice. If you want to join our conversation, perhaps you have a memory of Lucille Bluford, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. In the mid-70s, she went after a Kansas City police chief named Marvin Van Kirk in the wake of 10 unsolved murders of young black women. How outraged was she by that?
Lucille Bluford was very outraged about what was going on in Kansas City, and she wanted to ensure having that keen insight on the issues of exactly how women could protect themselves, keep themselves safe, because we couldn't even go out into the streets. We were so afraid at that time. And what I think that I remember the most, and in the research that I did that brought back some of those memories, was that here was this formidable woman, a trailblazer, a pioneering woman who is sharing these stories with all of us women. So we could look up to her. Mm-hmm. We could believe in her. And we could say, okay, we need to do these things. And we would pay attention.
You know, the chief wound up being fired so suddenly.
Yes, it did.
That, in fact, it surprised a lot of African Americans in town.
Yes, it did. But It was her writing. It was her voice, her journalistic voice, that really put people on edge when she told the truth about some of these things.
Yeah, you know, something else that really struck me about her, Sheila, and that is the fact that she never married. I got a sense that she was married to her job. Did she see it that way?
She absolutely saw it that way. From the research that I saw, she was married to the job of being a reporter, a publisher, an editor. She championed the equal access to decent jobs for folks, affordable health care, which was so important to all of us then, a better education for women and African Americans. So that was her job.
You know, here's another remembrance of Lucille Bluford. This is Louis Duguid, a longtime editor and columnist for The Star, remembering how Miss Bluford came to the rescue of a fellow black journalist.
A friend of mine, his name was Vernon Jarrett. He had been a longtime journalist in I believe it was Pittsburgh, for the black press. He got into trouble in his career, as many people of color do, with the Pittsburgh press. And he was essentially booted out of the news industry. Ms. Bluford allowed him to come to Kansas City to work as a journalist and photojournalism as well, so that he could regain his footing in the industry and then pick up a job in the Chicago market. So Ms. Bluford actually gave a safe harbor to a lot of African Americans who worked as journalists and helped them to develop their skills so that they could go on to other places. And if it weren't for people like her, doing the work that she has always done, people like me would never have had an opportunity to work for the white press.
That's, again, Louis Duguid recalling the life of Lucille Bluford. I want to ask about one other series of articles in the 60s, again, connected to the riots and Kansas City life following King's death, and the police shooting of a man named Julius P. Hamilton. What was that about?
You know, when that shooting occurred in Kansas City.
Describe what happened there.
Right. Well, I did not talk a lot about that in my book. But what happened there was that when the shooting happened, she thought that it was that the police, the community needed to stand up.
The accusation was that the police had shot Mr. Hamilton to death.
Right. And the community was outraged about that, mm-hmm. As was Ms. Bluford. And there was no stories being told on it. And she delved into the issues, as she would do, as the leader that she was. She got the NAACP involved, Freedom Incorporated, some others in the community involved, so that she could tell the real story of what was going on.
Again, journalist as activist in every sense of the word then.
Right, because this is a leader who was fighting injustices that served to the detriment, like this incident, of the African-American community. And you could only do that in a platform like the Black Press. And the Black Press has long been known, as Lewis stated, of helping and assisting and bringing about those stories, bringing them to life in the pages of the Kansas City Call.
Finally, today we have a remembrance from Kansas City historian Sonny Gibson, who once worked for Ms. Bluford as a call boy selling copies of the call. Sonny Gibson is an historian and author of Kansas City Early Negro History. Here's his remembrance of Lucille Bluford.
Well, Ms. Bluford was a person that she would look at you real hard. And she would say, Gibson, are you telling me the truth? I mean, on different issues. So you could work with her, but you couldn't come to her on some weak things. You had to be able to support your position. And that's how she was. The greatest impact she had on Kansas City was the way in which she managed the news at the Call paper. She knew how to pursue a point of view on an issue that affected the community, and she gave it her full support if it was correct. And the Call paper thrived on that. The Call paper has been a fundamental instrument in the Kansas City community. You know, the Call paper goes out all over the country. And so I think that it has been an instrument for change. It has been an instrument of voice on issues that affect the overall community. It has done a good job. Ms. Bluford is missed by everybody from a literary point of view. She was stern. She was available. She was visible in all issues that affected this community. And so she is missed tremendously even today.
Sheila, you think Lucille Bluford should have a national reputation?
Absolutely.
Why?
I do. It is fitting to honor Lucille Bluford because this is a woman who fought to provide a voice for the voiceless. This is a woman whose persistent advocacy for people of color, for women, it stands as a monument of truth to power. Mm-hmm. And it is so important. I am so pleased that the state of Missouri now honors Lucille Bluford on July 1st on her birthday. She would have been 107 years old last mm-hmm. week.
The state honors her how?
They have named it Lucille Bluford Day
wow.
in the state of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Did that in the state legislature last summer. And then now, just maybe a month or so ago, the University of Missouri has named a dorm in her honor. These are significant to the contributions that Lucille Bluford, an activist, a journalist, a trailblazer, has laid the foundation for so many.
Sheila Brooks' new book, Lucille H. Bluford and the Kansas City Call, Activist Voice for Social Justice. Again, Sheila speaks this evening about Lucille Bluford at 6:30 at the Central Library at 14 West 10th Street downtown. Sheila, what a pleasure to have you here.
It was great. And I just want to mention that Lucille's Bluford nephew, let's not forget who he was, Guyon Bluford, the first black astronaut in space.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Tomorrow on the show, former Kansas Governor John Carlin gives us his take on what the upcoming elections could mean for the future of Kansas. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.